In the Moment on SDPB is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 20th through 22nd in Brookings.
We are learning much about how this U.S. Supreme Court is shaping America. From SDPB, today is Monday, July 1st, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we discuss a few of the court's major decisions this term. We'll talk about the shifting influence of federal agencies, the Seventh Amendment, and the limitations the court places on prosecutors seeking to punish January 6th rioters. That's coming a bit later in the hour. Meanwhile, how do you think the economy is doing? We'll talk about inflation and how we feel about inflation with Joe Santos. But first, the big read returns to Rapid City, and an SDSU scientist is celebrated for her work in plant biology. That's coming up after the news. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the Moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The Rapid City Arts Council is one of 62 organizations nationwide selected to receive a 2024-2025 National Endowment for the Arts Big Read Grant. The NEA Big Read Grant will fund a community reading program in collaboration with the Rapid City Public Library. The book for this moment is the novel, The Bear, by Andrew Krivak. And it begins like this. The last two were a girl and her father who lived along the old eastern range. It is a story of human extinction, wild spaces, and myths as teachers and mentors. The novel asks deep questions about how we are to behave when we are the last of our kind. Jackie Dietrich is Executive Director of the Rapid City Arts Council and is joining us now from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Jackie, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Hello, Lori. It's nice to speak with you again.
Tell us a little bit about what a Big Read grant looks like in action in Rapid City.
Oh, sure. Well, this is in partnership with Arts Midwest, and it's really an opportunity for Rapid City to celebrate the theme, Where We Live, through literature and art. So this community-wide event will invite people to come together to read, to connect, to really create and explore our understanding of ourselves and really the world through this shared experience of this single book. So as an awardee, we'll be working in collaboration with local partners and, of course, our fabulous library and artists to really create and support an engaging literary and artistic programs that illuminate this theme of where we live. So our community partners will focus on outreach efforts to ensure that the community participation is really, really vibrant and reaches a broad and diverse group.
This is an opportunity for people to get excited and come together in community and all the fun things that go along with that and the fun things that come along with being a reader. But it's a serious book with some big, big themes. Tell me a little bit about the intersection between the delight of reading and the, I wouldn't say it's a heavy topic, you know, in the sense that it's, you know, going to weigh you down because it's a beautiful book, but it's also going to bring up some big questions.
Yeah, our selection of The Bear for the Big Read Rapid City was really intentional. Yeah. I mean, the story is reflective of our distinctive regional identity and this inextricable relationship that we have with nature as our world is defined by where we live. And as an arts organization, we really recognize that artistic and cultural heritage is inseparable from this relationship with nature. And, you know, we're really united by a tie to the environment, but our community is often fragmented. And so this novel is really a literary catalyst for how we're encouraging our community to explore diverse perspectives on the shared environment. But we think it'll be fun events. We'll start in December with a kickoff, and the events will go through July of 2025. They'll all be free and open to the public, and we'll really encourage community-wide involvement. We'll have book giveaways, discussions, presentations, writing and art workshops, an art exhibition, film screenings. We love the idea of evenings with a bear where we can do public readings and performances. I'm most excited about a collective wisdom events that really showcase our local experts in how we live in harmony with nature and how we really tune in to what's around us. Solstice walks and skill classes in outdoor settings, I think, all sound like a lot of fun.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the idea of being the last of humankind and how you explore that in community, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what really struck us is that in the Black Hills, our tie to the environment is so important. And as the Arts Council, our idea is that we can really bring people together through the power of the arts. And so this is really about creating a transformative experience of reading for the entire community, fostering literacy and encouraging those community conversations around a shared topic can be a really positive experience. And that the Bear is really a unique platform to collectively celebrate nature and to really investigate mm-hmm. those challenges and engage in community-wide discussions about supporting one another amidst all of those environmental challenges. And, you know, beyond reading and enjoying literature and the arts, it's about fostering those connections and really developing that mutual understanding of what's necessary for us as a community to be resilient today. Yeah. And I think that, you know, we really see it as that conduit for that meaningful dialogue.
What is the, say more about the visual artists and the partnerships between, you know, the literature and what might be, you know, visual art, painting, sculpture, music, other areas, other ways of knowing in the arts?
Oh, so really this book is an opportunity to bring together arts, sciences, indigenous knowledge, land management. I think it's a chance to really engage groups and partners that aren't always seen as being connected. And this is a chance for the community to really respond creatively to these topics. So it might be through, you know, the visual arts about what an artist sees as the human connection and relationship to art and what resilience looks like. It can be through song. It can be through dance. And of course, here in the Black Hills, we see, you know, hunting and the crafts around the indigenous community, as well as our connection to food. Like, all of that becomes part of our artistic and cultural heritage that can be expressed through this naturalist, outdoor, land management organization connections that we can create through this book. We're really excited about that.
Yeah, I'm excited too. Where do you want people to begin? Should they, you know, if they need a copy of the book, when does everything kick off? How do you want to leave people today with next steps for engagement?
Yeah, I just can't emphasize the importance enough of having community support and participation to make the Big Read Rapid City a true success. So we will be doing book giveaways starting in December in partnership with the library. We're super excited to have the Bookmobile as part of this project, so we'll be able to really get out deeply into the community. But for now, listeners can get involved, of course, in attending the events and participating in discussions as the date gets closer. But all of that information is available at rapidcityartscouncil.org on our Big Read page. And we're especially excited right now to be making connections with organizations that want to be a part of this and really help us to create this literary experience for the community.
Yeah. Jackie Dietrich, Executive Director of Rapid City Arts Council, thank you so much. I look forward to having more conversations with you about this as the Big Read unfolds.
Me too. Thanks, Lori.
Anne Fennell is a distinguished professor in the Department of Agronomy, Horticulture, and Plant Science at South Dakota State University. She has helped develop grapevine varieties that grow better in the cold and under stress, which means if you have ever raised a glass of wine made with North American grapes, you may have raised a glass to an SDSU professor. The American Society of Plant Biologists has named Fennell one of the 25 most inspiring women in plant biology. And Dr. Fennell is with us from SDPB's Janine Basinger studio at SDSU in Brookings. Anne Fennell, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
Professor, tell me a little bit about your lab at first, because I want to get right to the idea of research that's happening in South Dakota, students that are interacting with your lab and learning about what will happen for them after graduation or with further educational study. So ground us in the work that you do in the lab.
I work in the lab and I work in the field. I like to say that I go from the field to the DNA and the RNA back to the field. So when you're in that kind of area of genomics, which I've been in for quite a few years, I have a integrated lab because you need people that are working with plants, they have a love for plants. You need people that have computational skills. And so I tend to have mixed groups of people. I like to integrate the computational people into the lab so they understand what it takes to acquire the data. Mm-hmm. And then also you get the cross-training that you need to train scientists.
How did you come to love this kind of work? Was it always about grapevine rootstocks and hardiness, or was there an origin story about plants that brought you deeper into this kind of science?
I've always liked plants. I particularly like perennial plants. I grew up on a small farm. When I was going to go to school, to college, I'm one of 10 children that were first-generation college students. I didn't, there's that big thing of you got to pick a major. And I was kind of looking at this form, and I was looking at biology, and one of my older brothers said, I think you should try horticulture. You really like plants. And I did, and it stuck. And grapes, I guess, have just haunted me my whole life. I say that facetiously. Mm-hmm. I grew up picking wild grapes. And grapevines just are fascinating. They are very plastic. They are very adaptable to the environment. And they're fascinating. So that's kind of, I've worked on a lot of crops. I've worked on small grains. I've worked on strawberries. I've worked on ornamental plant material, prairie cordgrass. I've worked on weeds. Corn, but I kept coming back to grapes because I thought they were the perfect model system. Yeah. And I had the luck of stepping into genomics at the time that it was developing. So in 2003, the Human Genome was released. In 2007, the Grape Genome was released. So it was the fourth higher plant to be sequenced, and I went from there.
Why did the grape genome take such priority and precedent? Because I want to say, it's because there's a product, there's wine attached to it, but that's probably not thinking about it the right way. How would you answer that question?
I would agree with you that was a driving force. And it was the first reference genome that was released came out of France, and its grapes are highly heterozygous. That means your two arms of your chromosomes can be very different. And so they were not an easy plant material to sequence and assemble and annotate. So there was a lot of background work that took place in developing something that was more amenable to the technologies we had at that time.
Yeah.
And so when that sequence came out, and it was the year that I got my first big NSF grant, and so I was right there with the rest of them, I guess, so to speak.
So what was that year like for you? Because you spent so much time and then all of a sudden it's like, wait, now I can see a map in a way that you probably didn't imagine that you'd ever be able to see that when you were, picking wild grapes, right? Or maybe you did. So just tell
Correct.
Me what that
Well,
that
I always
knowledge.
Had it. Yeah. I always had that in my mind because I often got the question of why in the world are you working on grapes in South Dakota? Yeah. And the comments from people in California, Washington, Oregon, we don't need that sort of stuff. And my response always was bet on the bug or the disease.
Okay.
You have a very sure. narrow germplasm. Genetic base in what you're growing And if you want insect resistance, if you want disease resistance, if you want salt tolerance, if you want cold tolerance, you got to go to the native plant materials. Mm-hmm. And we're real fortunate in the U.S. because we have a large number of native species. Europe has one, Vitis vinifera. We've got between 30 and 32 different grapevine species in the North American continent. And think about it, you know, there's a thought process that they are genomic work that suggests that the origin of the grapevine is in the Southeast North America, and then it spread across the land bridge into Asia and across. And Asia is the other major center of diversity in grapevine.
Wow. So I had no
idea.
If
you are challenged with something like that, you need to maintain that material. So it's really important in all of our plant materials that we are maintaining the wild relatives.
And how is the importance, the desire to, the imperative to maintain the wild relatives changing in your work today as the climate changes?
So I could answer that question in a couple of ways. Number one, all along the time we have been both here and around the world, established repositories are there. So materials are sort of backed up. But in terms of climate change, you can breed and try to develop new cultivars that can withstand the conditions, which is what grape breeders have been doing for quite a long time. But you can also, as a horticulturist, I'm trained as a horticulturist, so you would use every trick that you can use in plant production to maintain things in a challenging environment. And one of the things that we use is grafting. So we're putting two different genomes together. Mm-hmm. And grapevines are very plastic, responsive to their environment. Now we're bringing two different genetic backgrounds to play. One that's in the soil, so dealing with soil environments, and the other, the scion, which it grows the fruit that we want to eat, is in the air. And by combining those two things, that is what they use to survive the phloxera epidemic, which everybody talks about it in terms of Europe, but it also happened in Mexico and California, where to save the grape industry from this root louse, they were grafted onto native plant materials. In that case, most of it came from North America.
Oh, that's
so the species that I have spent most of my time working on is from that background. And so we're using the power of genetics, natural genetics, and combining the two forces together. We don't always know how that works, and that's what I've spent a bit of time working on.
A bit of time, yes. All right, Professor Anne Fennell, Distinguished Professor in the Department of Agronomy, Horticulture and Plant Science at South Dakota State University. American Society of Plant Biologists has named Fennell one of the 25 most inspiring women in plant biology. Dr. Fennell, I hope you will come back and talk to us more about your work in the future.
Thank you. With pleasure.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For our last Monday macro conversation, Joe Santos explored the disconnect between how economists and consumers might describe the U.S. economy. Santos is director of SDSU's Ness School of Management and Economics, and he is with us today to talk about the inflation fallacy. He's seated in the Janine Basinger studio at SDPB's spot in Brookings. Joe, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori.
All right. This is a fascinating data-informed look after our last conversation to see what you have done at school.blog.com, which is where all the companion blogs for Monday Macro are stored. I had fun. And I mean that word. I had fun, Joe. Looking at the charts and going through everything that you put together. For people who didn't hear us talk last time, help explain why we're so curious about how we measure the economy versus how people feel about what's happening in the economy.
Yeah, so you motivated that discussion, for which I was very grateful. And you said, what's going on? It looks like the economy's doing well when you look at the data. But when you ask anybody, they have a very different, we'd say, sentiment that they express about the economy. They're not too pleased with it. And so what explains that disconnect? And so you and I were talking about it, and others have talked about it. We all sort of come to the same thing, and that is it really sort of freaks people out when they look at the prices of goods and services right now relative to what those prices were, say, in, I don't know, 2019. These prices are much higher now, and it doesn't matter how much you tell them the unemployment rate is low, because it is, or that output is high, because it is, or that even inflation is coming down, because it is. It doesn't matter. The inflation, the growth in the price level, really disturbs folks. And so that's it. It's the inflation. The inflation explains the disconnect. And I stand by that, and I'm sure you do too. That's where we ended the discussion last time. But as I walked away, I was actually in the studio that day, and I walked away and went down Phillips. And as I walked, I thought, but what about the inflation fallacy? And so that's where I picked up this month.
Yes. So let's talk a little bit about what that is from the macroeconomic terminology.
If you write down a model, as we like to say, of the economy, and you say, okay, I'm going to write this model down, all these equations, and I'm going to give this model inflation, and then you try to theorize about how individuals living in that economy are going to be really put off by this inflation. What are the costs going to be? And now we're not talking about hyperinflation. We're talking about, 2, 4, 6%, that sort of variety. What will the burdens be? And what you realize very quickly is there isn't a very strong case for why anybody would be so put off by inflation. And here's the fundamental explanation. It has to do with the fact that every time, let's say, you and I engage in an economic transaction, let's say with each other, you sell me something for $5, I pay $5, you receive or think earn $5. So every transaction in the economy includes a buyer and a seller. And when the buyer is paying a higher price, the seller is receiving a higher price. So incomes would just adjust with the price level. So in theory, if prices go up by 10%, I give you $5 and 10% more, you receive $5 and 10% more. Your income went up with the inflation rate. And I sell somebody something too, and my income goes up with the inflation rate. So incomes really don't lose purchasing power as a result of inflation, at least not for very long. So when folks say, my gosh, everything is so much more expensive now, at the average level, so too is their income higher. So the fallacy is that individuals' income loses purchasing power. It does not a lot of theoretical or even practical substantiation for that. It's not to say inflation isn't burdensome, and we can go into this, and there is one sort of way in which I think folks are really burdened by it right now. But it's not the sort of go-to explanation, with all due respect, most folks have, which is my income doesn't go as far as it once did. Actually, your income's probably adjusting rather quickly to higher prices because your income is itself a reflection of selling labor services in that case, and that earns a wage, which is a price, which adjusts rather quickly.
Yeah. All right. I want to go back and ground people in the pandemic right now, because there was this time, the pandemic, massive unemployment. When you look at the charts, you just see everything completely spike. We wanted to keep the economy going.
Yep.
Everybody wanted to buy things, but they couldn't get them because the supply chain felt like it was collapsing under our feet. But there were stimulus checks. So the employment was high, the interest rates were low, the stimulus checks were coming, but nobody could buy the things that they wanted to buy because you couldn't get them to the places. So this was this entire massive disruption that in a lot of ways, when I look at, if I'm interpreting your charts and graphs correctly, we have recovered from, with some exceptions, but we have not forgotten about them. So when you think about that, how much of the memory is challenged by, because what I'm trying to get at is I'm still going back and saying, were those stimulus checks a terrible idea? Were they a good idea? Did they go too far? But then when I look at those unemployment numbers, I am humbled that I even had a job during that time, because boy, a lot of people didn't. And I'm just trying to put into context how I feel about all this disruption. Pull out what I just dumped on you and tell me what it brings up for you.
I think you're onto something, and I think it's why. And I should say, you know, I don't get hate mail for this segment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, but I may after this, because, you know, folks think, you know, how dare you say inflation isn't burdensome? I'm not saying, you know, it's not burdensome, but it's to your point. I think it's carrying sort of the water, if you will, for a lot more economic stress and trauma that we experienced during and after the pandemic, and we're attaching to inflation a lot of that you know, stress and trauma. So that's not to say inflation isn't harmful, because it is. And I should say, the one way I think, there are a couple ways, but one way I think folks, some consumers, some households are experiencing a very real burden with inflation right now, is those folks who have borrowed to purchase homes and borrowed recently. You know, you and I have talked about how you got in, you know, when rates are low and so on. Well, folks, not everybody has, of course. And for those folks who have locked in recently, they have locked in at higher mortgage rates. And this is a little technical, but the fact is those mortgage rates went up, but the expectation of inflation really hasn't gone up all that much, which is, in simple terms to say, the real burden of servicing debt has gone up. We've talked about this from other angles. We've said things like that, you know, that R star, we affectionately referred to that natural rate of interest and so on, has gone up. Well, that means that if folks are borrowing right now, they are transferring, if you will, more resources from themselves to their lenders, right? So they're paying more for these loans. So folks who are servicing loans right now that they originated recently, that is to say, since interest rates have gone up, are feeling a real pain. It's not enough to just say, oh, come on, but inflation will erode the purchasing power of that debt and you'll be fine and blah, blah, blah. And actually, they won't. They are paying higher real interest rates for those loans. And when you put that together with higher real estate prices more generally because of housing, you know, issues that we've talked about, that is very, very real. So I don't want to downplay some of this. But again, the fallacy just refers to the income piece. Yeah. Incomes do adjust rather quickly to inflationary pressures. And so that's what, to be fair to macroeconomists, they're referring to as the fallacy. It's that not to say that no one is burdened by inflation, but that's typically not the way it introduces the burden into your life.
Yeah, we're not telling you you're thinking about it wrong. We're telling you, like, this is a really interesting thing to unpack what's happening. So, and who is disproportionately impacted by those high interest rates? Not people like me who've been in their house since 1999. It's the first time home buyer. It's the college graduate who maybe wants to get married and have kids and look for their house earlier in their career. It's a lot of middle class people who are, or people who are trying to downsize maybe. It affects a lot of people, but not, I think that's just really compelling. And the political consequences, I mean, we're not talking about politics now, but there are political consequences to who you have just alienated.
That's right. Because there are certain folks, if you've described them well, who are going to be burdened by this in ways that are unique to them, and they will, again, they rightly attach it to the inflation rate. They're not wrong in that way. And in their view, the economy is not serving their needs in the way that, you know, they imagine it might. I should say, you know, really make sort of our heads explode like those emojis that you see. You know, a lot of this has to do with if you will, the effectiveness of monetary policy. I know that's a really nerdy avenue to go down, but, you know, the central bank is very intentionally trying to deal with the inflation problem. And the way they're doing that is they're keeping interest rates higher, as we like to say, higher for longer, it seems these days. Well, they're very intentionally raising the real interest rate, the burden that will be imposed on borrowers when they borrow at these higher rates. Like that's not unintentional. That's exactly how you slow that economy down and ease the inflation rate. So this is just the other side of that coin, if you will, of saying that the central bank is raising rates and bringing down inflation and anchoring expectations of inflation and blah, blah, blah. Well, one very basic household implication of that is if you're a borrower and you're locking in these higher rates, you are not just paying more in dollars when you pay back your loan. You're paying more in the stuff equivalent of dollars.
Yeah,
you're giving more resources to that lender than you would otherwise because those rates are higher.
Yeah. So it's not that your wage isn't covered the prices.
Right,
it's that all your money's going over. All your money's going over here. All your money's going to your mortgage and your healthcare.
That's right. That's right. Your wage may be adjusting to the inflation. That's right.
Yeah. So you still can't buy the thing that you thought that you could buy. I think we have a little delay between our two studios that's making us talk over each other right now. So I'm gonna wrap and direct people to schooled.blog.com so they can see all of this work online. Joe Santos, thank you so much for being here. It is always such a great conversation.
Thank you so much, Laurie.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Laurie Walsh. This morning, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled an American president has absolute immunity for core constitutional powers, but lacks immunity for unofficial acts. Well, which of Donald Trump's actions were part of his official duties? That is still an open question. NPR brings you Supreme Court coverage and analysis throughout the day. Meanwhile, we have learned much about how this court operates, including how the justices weigh stare decisis. That's the idea of precedent, or standing by what has already been decided. And conversely, overturning legal decisions of the past to create laws that this court says make more sense for today. Now, the court has recently decided to change a few things, including the influence of federal agencies. Mike Thompson is a professor of criminal justice at the University of Sioux Falls. He stopped by the studio this morning to discuss the Administrative Procedures Act, the Security and Exchange as it intersects with the Seventh Amendment, and the importance of the word otherwise in deciding how to prosecute people who allegedly obstructed Congress on January 6th. Take a listen.
I'd like to talk about the Loper Bright Enterprises. That is the case that overruled Chevron. It's a Administrative Procedures Act case. Mm-hmm. Chevron, the Administrative Procedures Act passed in 1946, and that was in response to the Roosevelt's administration use of executive branches to make regulations and regulate all kinds of activity. The Administrative Procedures Act was passed to rein in some of that executive power. So all of these federal agencies are able to pass regulations like the Clean Water Act regulations, EPA regulations, Department of Education regulations. And the courts, when they're interpreting the statute or the regulation, Chevron required them, the standard of review, the way the court had to review the record before it, was they had to defer to the executive branch agency's interpretation. Okay. If that was reasonable, they had to accept it. That was Chevron's command. So the Loper Enterprises case says that we don't have to do that anymore, that you've usurped an Article III judicial branch authority. So we're not going to do that anymore. We can certainly consider the views of the people who drafted the regulation as to its interpretation, but we're not granting any more deference to you. We're accepting it as a fact, just like any other fact.
And this is a big deal, partially because it overturns this 40-year precedent, which we're always watching for, to say there's a new court and they're making new decisions. What's the significance of overturning that precedent, just from a legal standing?
Well, I think it depends on how heavy you hold stare decisis in your heart. Lots of courts will avoid overturning precedent because they just have respect for what came before. This court seems more open to disregarding precedent. And I can't explain necessarily why, other than the change in the court membership. Mm-hmm. But lots of people think that the Loper Enterprise, the court that overrules Chevron, is going to be a huge change in how administrative agencies operate. I'm not so sure that's the case. There's judicial review. Yeah. There's just not this deference.
Yeah. There's some alarmist headlines. This guts the EPA. OSHA is next. Workplace safety. All these things that we rely on executive branch or federal agencies to regulate, that's all upturned right now. And you're saying maybe don't be quite so alarmist about this. How come?
Well, the Administrative Procedures Act requires if an agency like the Department of Labor, for example, wants to change a Fair Labor Standards Act regulation, they have to introduce their proposed rule. It gets public comment. They'll go back and maybe amend the rule. It receives public comment, and then they'll finally issue, okay, here's what our final rule is. So it goes through a vetting process, the regulation does at that point. And so that's still going to be subject to public view, public input, that whole procedure. And all this, okay, and maybe I always say I'm naive. Maybe that's changing, I don't know. But the Administrative Procedures Act, all this case does is say, we're not going to grant the deference anymore. Mm. We're going to listen to every side, and we're going to interpret it like we, the judicial branch, think it should be interpreted.
Okay.
Doesn't mean it's going to change the outcome of a whole bunch of regulation. But the other thing also is speed.
That was my next question, The idea of it being bogged down by these efforts to, you think about the Environmental Protection Agency regulation, slowing that down. Some of these things are quite urgent.
Right. They are quite urgent. And, anytime you get something in a court, it is going to slow things down incredibly.
Do you see an open door? Does this hit a domino?
No, I don't see that. Yeah. I see this as it's a procedural case. This is about how the courts operate when it comes to administrative regulations, which is a huge area of the law.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about SEC next.
Oh, the SEC, yes. One that hasn't...
We're in the weeds.
Yeah, one that hasn't... caught a whole bunch of headlines, but this and the Seventh Amendment has to feel bad about that because the Seventh Amendment doesn't get much play anyway. But
what
it does.
Is the Seventh Amendment?
The Seventh Amendment says that I get the right to a trial by jury in lawsuits at common law where the amount in controversy is $20 or more, is what the Seventh says. So the Securities and Exchange Commission is responsible to enforce the securities acts and things. And if they want to bring a lawsuit against somebody for civil penalties, of course, the SEC can't impose a criminal penalty, but they can impose a monetary penalty. The SEC can try the case within the agency in front of an administrative law judge, and then that would be subject to judicial review.
Okay.
But the Supreme Court says, the Seventh Amendment says, we need to have a jury trial. Before you can impose a civil penalty, the defendant has to have the right to a jury trial. Like, of course, the defendant can always waive it, but they have to have the right to a jury trial. Interpreting the Seventh, I rarely see a Seventh Amendment case. So this was kind of fun to read about how they're interpreting that. One interesting thing, I think, is the Seventh Amendment refers to suits at common law. And the court says in this case that they're not going to interpret what suits at common law means according to founding era determinations. They're going to look at it throughout the history of the Republic, which is different from our Second Amendment jurisprudence, where we're looking to founding era understandings of what gun rights meant or mean.
That feels significant to me. From the same court who we just talked about how they interpreted the Second Amendment, yeah. Are they interpreting the Seventh differently? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. Okay. That's what I'm saying. They take a broader look at what we should believe are suits at common law.
Do they have justification for that?
Well, I hate to give an opinion. I don't think so.
In their writings, they haven't addressed that directly and said we're doing this way because of this. It's just what we're noticing.
Yeah, I think part of it is because the common law itself can change. Common law is judge-made law. It's decisional law.
Okay.
So throughout time, decisional law can change and add to what are considered to be suits at common law. But on the other side, under the Second Amendment, of course, over time, decisional law can change. So I think it's interesting and something to be aware of.
Let's go back to one that has gotten a lot of coverage nationally, but we haven't talked with you about, which is the homelessness decision. Cities can punish people for sleeping in public places. We talked about this beforehand.
We did, yeah. When it was argued, we talked about it, yeah.
Update us on what exactly is going on with this case. Or, you know, about a city trying to figure out what to do about people putting up tents and sleeping.
Right. Grants Pass, Oregon. Oregon is the plaintiff. Or they're the ones getting sued, I'm sorry. And they have a statute that prevents camping in public places. And if you're caught camping in public places, there is a graduated punishment scheme for that, fines and things, banishment from a certain camping area. Mm. The Ninth Circuit said, the appellate court that covers California, said that if I'm sleeping in a camping area and there are no beds for me in a homeless shelter, for example, then you can't punish me for that, because at that point you're punishing me for being homeless. Mm. And the Constitution, the Eighth Amendment Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, forbids that, according to Supreme Court precedent. Supreme Court said, no, this camping statute is a law of general applicability, which means it's not targeting status. It's targeting people camping in public areas. The precedent for Grants Pass is a case called Robinson versus California. And in that case, California tried to criminalize the status of drug addiction. They, of course, in that case in Robinson, you can criminalize the possession of a drug, but the court said you cannot criminalize the status of being an addict. And here the court says, well, there's not a criminalization of a status of an addict. These laws don't particularly address the status.
The status of homelessness.
Mm-hmm. They address where I can camp. A byproduct might be that homeless people are ending up in jail or paying fines over sleeping someplace where they have nowhere else to sleep.
Right.
But that's not the target of the law.
So the court is essentially saying, if that's the byproduct of your law that your community passes, then you're going to deal with the byproduct of that. But it's not necessarily a constitutional. Do you see this coming up again in the future? Or is this settled?
Well, no. I think it might come up in the future, just not under the Eighth Amendment, the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, because the court talks about that clause is always dealt with punishment. It's not dealt with application of the criminal law.
All right. So if people end up in jail or incarcerated for long periods of time because the snowball rolled downhill.
Yeah.
They were homeless. They slept somewhere. They got a fine. They couldn't pay the fine. They ended up having a warrant. All these things happened to them. Then does it come back to, like, at what point is the punishment meeting the crime?
Well, if following that, and I'm in the jail, and they say we're gonna put you in solitary confinement because you were camping where you shouldn't have been, that would be an Eighth Amendment question.
Yeah.
whether my punishment is fitting what I did. The courts pointed out that there are very few penalties for this that are very harsh. Mm-hmm. They didn't foresee it as filling up our jails with homeless people.
All right. There is another case here from the Supreme Court that's tied to January 6th. Tell me a little bit about Fisher.
Fisher versus the United States. In response to the Enron bankruptcy, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act was passed in 2002. That has a statute. So this is a matter of statutory construction. This is not a constitutional issue. But the statutes talk about criminalizing any activity that alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, blah, 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 with intent to impair the object's integrity or available for use in an official proceeding. The next subsection also criminalizes anyone who otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any judicial proceeding or attempts to do so. So a number, I'm not sure the number, but some rioters from January 6th were convicted under that residual clause is what the court calls it. This is so fascinating, isn't it? Residual clauses in interpreting the word otherwise. So the court says that the word otherwise is limited by the clause that comes before it. So it would mean it doesn't cover. The dissent points out, and Amy Coney Barrett joined two people of what have been labeled liberal justices in the dissent, saying, we agree that this counting the votes was an official proceeding, and these people obstructed it. What more do you need? And the majority of those said, well, the otherwise obstructs means that I have to destroy some document that's integral to the proceeding.
They're off the hook.
Well, the question that's left open is whether people who have been convicted under that language, whether their convictions, whether that rule be applied retroactively, and whether their convictions they'll be able to contest those convictions. Most of the time, the Supreme Court won't apply a rule retroactively.
Okay.
So, but definitely, if you're going to convict someone who rioted on January 6th, can't use that statute anymore.
Okay. Does that set up anything for the future? Not really.
No, I think it's very narrow.
It's just, hey, this was a dead end for you. You were trying really hard to convict these people, and this is not the way to do it.
Right. Exactly.
Meanwhile, are they in jail? I mean, we're talking the big policy academic, but, you know, this is people's lives.
Right. Right.
And
I'd really be upset if I had been convicted under this statute and I'm serving a 5-year sentence and they say, hey, you shouldn't have been. Yeah. And then they don't apply the rule retroactively. So I get to sit in my 5 and the people who haven't been to trial yet don't.
NPR brings you Supreme Court analysis throughout the day. Stay right here on SDPB. But that is our show for today, and we hope that it served you. On the next In the Moment, the Supreme Court cases you should understand. If you're a teacher, our Teacher Talk conversation explores the cases that have changed how we educate America's children, and we ask, how do they impact classroom best practices for teachers today? Plus, it started out as a South Dakota gas station cafe, and it evolved into a winner of a James Beard Classics Award. Let's head to the Pheasant Restaurant and Lounge in Brookings to celebrate good food and family traditions. From all of us at STPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.